And so many Republicans saying stop funding the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, should we as citizens, should we believe that when politicians speak in public, they are expressing a principled perspective? Or is it more likely that they're actually saying things that reflect domestic political considerations? I have to say, and I don't mean to be cynical, I have to say I'm in the latter camp. So yeah, so now that Biden owns the Ukraine war, we see lots of Republicans sounding dovish or at the very least cautious with regard to the use of force. I'm not persuaded that the positions staked out today by Democrats and Republicans reflect principled points of view as opposed to what's politically convenient in the moment.
Going back to Iraq, and in a moment we're going to be speaking with a well-known Iraqi-American who, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, left Minneapolis and said, I don't care if I just have to sweep the streets of my city of Najaf. I'm going to be there with my people, and has now returned. We see that President Putin has been now charged by the International Criminal Court with war crimes. The question of where American officials should stand, not 20 years later, but even 10 or before that. President Obama was famous for saying we should always just look forward. But for culpability when it comes to the destruction of this nation of Iraq, what about George W. Bush, who yesterday I was saying on the show, just a day after 9/11, when we know 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, was pushing his counterterrorism czar, Richard Clark, on the issue of Iraq. How can we make that connection? And Richard Clark was saying back to him, there is zero connection. But then what this means, what this led to, should he also be charged with war crimes and should others be in the dock with him?
Well, first of all, there's no question. In my opinion, that the Iraq war initiated by the United States, a war of choice, was a crime, a really horrid crime. I'm probably easier on President Bush than many other people are. I view him as an individual really of limited talent, to put it bluntly. He became president because his last name was Bush. He was an unimaginative figure and was utterly unprepared for what happened on September 11th. And his reaction, which I wouldn't defend, I think is primarily attributable to the associates that he chose to surround himself with. In other words, if I'm looking for bad guys, I don't begin by looking at Bush. I begin with Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Condoleezza Rice, people who fancied themselves to be strategic thinkers. They fancied themselves to have a grasp of world politics, who believed that American military might was so great that we would sweep aside Saddam Hussein's forces and some vast benefit would result. Well, they miscalculated. They were utterly wrong. And so when I'm looking for somebody to blame, I tend to blame those people more than Bush, not letting Bush off the hook. He was the commander in chief. But again, I think in at least some sense, it was not his hands that were on the controls.
If Bush was so untalented, why couldn't the largest anti-war movement in the world stop him? And it's not only in the United States. I mean, remember February 15th, 2003. Millions of people took to the streets of the world to stop the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Well, I don't think Bush or anybody in the Bush administration cared about world opinion. I mean, they cared about whether or not they were going to be able to line up certain allies, like Great Britain, to support the war. In that, they succeeded. No shame on Tony Blair. But I don't think world opinion factored in a large sense in the inner circles of Washington, D.C. But your larger question is, because I remember those, I happened to be in New York City, in Manhattan, on the day of the, was it February, I think, 15th?
February 15th, 2003.
Moving, massive, astonishing, and I think had zero political impact. Why? Well, I think that says something about our democracy, that, you know, elites tend to bow toward, you know, the will of the people. But then when they sit around the table and they make decisions related to war and peace, I don't think that they think very seriously about, well, you know, what do the folks back in Indiana think? Their calculation is shaped by considerations of power. And again, I would say with regard to the Bush administration in 2003, when the war began, radically defective understanding of the war, understanding of ourselves, understanding of the potential of American military power. So our leadership, elected and appointed, was stupid. The people actually, I think, had a better grasp of the dangers that we were undertaking when we went to war with Iraq.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, I want to thank you so much for joining us, chair of the board and co-founder of the anti-war think tank Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, retired colonel, Vietnam War veteran, professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. His latest book on shedding an obsolete past, bidding farewell to the American century. He's speaking to us from Punta Gorda, Florida. We'll link to your latest piece in the Boston Globe, headlined "The Self-Deceived Deceivers of War." Coming up, we continue with our week-long 20th anniversary of the Iraq War special by going to Minneapolis to speak with Sami Rasuli, a beloved Iraqi-American restaurateur in Minneapolis who moved back to Iraq after the U.S. invasion to be in his home country where he founded Muslim Peacemaker Team. Now he's back. Stay with us.
حاولت تهرب وتناسى السلطان ورميت المرصى بمواني السبع بحار يما كأني بعدني بنفس المكان وجداني وهمومي لسه جوا الدار حاول
I will return by Narsi, Yo-Yo Ma, and Mashru Leila. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look back at the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we're joined by Sami Rasuli, who we've spoken to numerous times over the past 20 years. He was an Iraqi native who immigrated to the United States over 35 years ago. He became a successful restaurateur and beloved member of the community in Minneapolis. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq, his home country, in 2003, he moved back to Iraq, where he founded Muslim Peacemakers. In a moment, Sami will join us live from Minneapolis. But first, I want to go back to 2004, where Sami appeared on Democracy Now! To discuss his plan to move back to Iraq in the midst of the U.S. war.
I would do anything, anything. Probably I'll start cleaning the streets where my sister lives and get those kids who like to listen to their uncle. to come and help me, and probably we do a lot of things and get the people influenced by rebuilding their country again.
That was Sami Rasulli in 2004 when I visited him in Minneapolis. In 2008, I interviewed Sami during the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. Sami was back from Iraq at that point. He criticized then-vice presidential nominee Joe Biden's proposal to partition Iraq.
As you and the audience, the viewers, and many Iraqis still remember Mr. Biden when he introduced the bill to the Congress last year to partition Iraq. Now he came back on the ticket. So that was not a surprise, for me at least, because the surge has accomplished one of its objectives, that Iraq is ready to be partitioned. By expelling or displacing more than 5 million Iraqis within the country and outside of the country.
You know, that was 5 days after I was arrested in St. Paul as we were covering a protest along with my Democracy Now! Colleagues, Sharif Abdelkaddous and Nicole Salazar. The police went after us, them for filming, and me for asking for them to be released. Well, in 2011, Democracy Now! Spoke to Sami again on the phone from his home at that point in Najaf, Iraq. The interview took place just after President Obama declared an end to the war in Iraq.
In sense of destroying Iraq, it's really mission accomplished. The healthcare system has been really destroyed, as you mentioned. The infrastructure as a total catastrophe that began not only since 2003, and actually it's more than 20 years since 1991. You know, we should not forget the effect of the sanction before the invasion. The Iraqi people have suffered a lot, and many of them have died.
While President Obama pledged to remove all troops from Iraq by the end of 2011, today, more than a decade later, there are still more than 2,500 U.S. troops in Iraq, and violence has continued in Iraq as well. In 2020, in just one example, a bomb destroyed the American Institute for English in Najaf, Iraq, the school that was founded by our guest, Sami Rasulli. At the time of the bombing, Sami was visiting the United States. Since then, he's remained here with his family, which was finally reunited at the end of last year, his wife and son returning to be with him and their kids. He's now working on starting a new organization called the American Iraqi Peace Initiative. Sami Rasulli, it's great to have you back with us as I talk to you from New York, and you're sitting in a studio in Minneapolis. It's amazing to go back on that journey. As we met you in Minneapolis, the anti-war movement so warmly supported you, the whole community at your restaurant in Minneapolis. But then you said, I'm closing it all up, and I don't care if I have to just sweep the streets of Najaf. I'm going to improve my country in any small way I can, as the U.S. bombs were falling. Take us on that journey 20 years later and how you ended up back in the United States. But talk about that first decision you made from your comfortable abode in Minneapolis to say, I'm going back to Iraq.
Hello, Amy. Thank you for having me, and thank you for reviewing our past meetings. It has been a while since we met. Anyway, I'm back now. And regarding your question, I always tell my listeners that, and friends, of course, that Sami and Salmon the fish has something in common, that they go upstream. But they also have no in common that Salmon doesn't come back, but Sammy keeps come back, because my good friend Jeremy Eggers here from Minneapolis said, Sammy, remember, you always wanted to build a bridge for peace between the two countries, your country of birth and your country of choice. So remember, that bridge has two ends. You have to maintain both ends. That meant to come back again and go back. So wherever I go, that's my home, and I'm privileged to have that. As you mentioned, eventually I got reunited with my wife and my stepson. My family and I survived. My dreams and school has been destroyed in Najaf back in September 2020. After killing Iranian General Soleimani by Mr. Trump.
At the Iraq airport.
Well, correct, in Baghdad airport, yes. Well, it looks like my wife, my kids, and I are safe now here. But the war in Iraq 20 years ago have left scars and visible legacy. And this is the babies in Fallujah and Najaf and Basra. And the rise of the incidence of cancer, if we speak in general, fourfolds went up. But among the kids, 12 times went up, and that's catastrophic. The gruesome deformality of newborn babies, whether in Najaf or in Fallujah, keeps happening as a witness for the crimes committed against peaceful nation in 2003. And that brings the question, how are we going to deal with that? I always said, a just compensation. A just compensation to respect that nation and leave that nation alone. That nation is rich in its resources. But unfortunately, Bush's administration's representative by Paul Bremer assigned people that are incompetent, they have nothing to do with leading a country, such a country called the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia. They are just selling each part of the country out to others. And we, as the people of Iraq, living in an insecure country, and actually it's not state, lossless state. So there is no security, there is no respected economic system, social system, health system, education system. And when I say just compensation, I mean to build a new culture here, the backyard of the rest of the world, the United States of America. The new culture that based on justice and peace, that deal with, for example, local, domestic, severely affected all of us. It's a school mass shooting since Columbine in April 20th, 1999. We haven't done yet anything to prevent that, because since that shooting,
1999, up to date, there are about 366 school mass shooting happened already. And those disturbed kids that receiving very bad education system by their political leaders, I should emphasize, because at school they teach them how to be kind and nice to their neighbors, to their friends, and teach them not to be racist against any colors or other people that they meet, to be diversified. But again,
Sammy,
they are told the same thing by their parents.
I wanted to interrupt for one second because you're making an extremely interesting point as you talk about, you know, this country being really the only place in the world that has this level of mass shootings day after day. And you go back to Columbine. As you said, Columbine was April 20th, 1999. And I'll never forget President Clinton's comments at the time. What was it, three days later, that the U.S.-backed NATO forces, for example, bombed RTS, the radio television studio, in Belgrade, Serbia. And we saw the body parts of makeup artists and technicians being taken out of this civilian structure. That was just one example. But Columbine happening in the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia, and President Clinton saying, how do we teach our children that violence is not the answer to resolving conflict? And the irony of this, with the backdrop of war, then Yugoslavia, in your case, we're talking about Iraq, and now talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Right. I mean, kids, the adolescents, I mean, they were like 12 years old or 17 years old, the perpetrators. Those kids, and they come as a challenge for their surrounding world. They would like to make some changes in this stage of age. So to tell them at school and at home, violence is bad and we should not do it, but yet we are doing it by our political leaders in Iraq and Syria and other places. And we tell them that's good, but the violence, for example, or attacking Ukraine today is not okay. So we are, what we're doing, we are contributing to disturb their minds, their psyche, and eventually they end up with the conclusion that human life has no value, whether it's their friends, their classmates, or their enemies, and bullying their classmates if they are bigger or stronger. Just they seen it when the U.S. as a superpower country goes and march in Iraq with no reason and destroy the country and come back and go after that to Syria, destroy it to Libya, and the saga will continue. So that should be ended. And as I said, a new culture of peace and justice should lead our mind and hearts, not only at home and at school, but also in the Pentagon and the White House and the Congress.
Sammy, so, I wanted to ask you about 2015. President Trump was running, Donald Trump was running for president on a fiercely anti-Muslim platform. We know, you know, right after he came into office, the Muslim ban, et cetera. But you invited him to Iraq as part of a cultural exchange program for Muslim peacemaker team. If you can talk about establishing the Muslim peacemakers, working with Christian peacemakers in the anti-war movement, and why you wanted Trump to come to Iraq.
Well, Emmy, you remember when we met in Minneapolis back, I think, in 2004? You visited Minneapolis, and you interviewed me, and you asked me, you brought part of that meeting earlier in the show. So I told you I am going with no clue what I'm going to do, but at least I'm going to go and sweep my sister, where she lives, the house, and or the street where she lives in. So accidentally, with no previous plans, I met the Christian peacemaker teams there, and they were a great guidance for me to establish the Muslim peacemaker teams. So I'm still thankful for them to create all the roots and the initial movement that Muslim peacemaker teams follow their footsteps to work together in many projects. So one of them, when Mr. Biden banned Muslim countries, among them Iraq, not to enter the U.S., then excluded Iraq, I remember. But still, what I did, Somalia, because it was also excluded. So I flew to Somalia to bring Somalia and Iraq together, and we signed an agreement with the authority in Bosaso, and that's in Puntland area, way in the north, to make Najaf and Bosaso sister cities, since both of them are sister cities of Minneapolis. So we built that triangle as a reaction for Mr. Trump. But at the same time, I sent a letter inviting Mr. Trump to come and learn about the facts, how a Muslim family operates, and how the Muslim family conduct its business with the neighbors, with the kids, with the school teachers, and with their guest, him, if he come and stay with us at home to watch us rather than to listen to the mainstream media. Because, you know, the mainstream media in the U.S., they picture the Muslims as terrorists. And the mainstream media in the Middle East, they picture the European and the Western, among them, the Americans, as infidels. So here comes the duty of Muslim peacemaker teams when the Muslim peacemaker teams bring both together, the infidel and the terrorist, halfway, have them sit in a round table, look in the eyes, break that piece of bread, share it, and they find out all that nonsense of terrorism or infidels has no values, but they are nothing but brothers and sisters in humanity. And they should pursue this concept, that peaceful concept, to respect each other and share what they have together.
Sami Brazouli, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Beloved Iraqi-American restaurateur in Minneapolis who moved back to Iraq after the U.S. invasion, founded the Muslim Peacemaker Team, and now is back in Minneapolis 20 years later. Someday soon, I hope to come to Minneapolis and share a meal with you, break bread with you and your community. Thank you so much, Sami. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Follow us on social media at CJSF on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram at CJSF Radio. Listen to old episodes and special programming on our SoundCloud at CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.